reaching from way down here.
Yeah.
From way down here.
Welcome to Thread, a podcast designed to explore God's story and lead you into a full life in Christ.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation, co-hosted by myself, Hannah D'Souza, and Dr. David Pachter.
Though I'm way down here, I get a better view of this boundless world that I'm going to.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Thread. Now we are over halfway through our series, God's Nation Formed. We are at episode 24, which will be the law and the priesthood. And we have another special guest with us this week. We're very fortunate to have Tanner Visage with us. Hi, Tanner.
Yay, Tanner.
And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about yourself for everyone listening.
Sure. It's good to see you guys. My name is Tanner Visage, and my wife and I currently reside just outside of Chicago, Illinois, in a little suburb called Wheaton. We've got two little boys, and we've been married for 10 years. We've been working in the ministry for 11 years now in a church called the Chicago Church of Christ. It's a larger multi-site church with 7 locations across Chicagoland. So I've worn a few different hats over the past 11 years that I've lived here and worked in this church, but currently we're working with the young family ministry and teaching and education role that is integrating throughout the whole Chicago church. So it's really cool to be on here. I've been working with Dave for about the past year, figuring out how to integrate Thread throughout our congregation. And I've known Hannah for a couple years now, off and on from different conferences and events. And so it's really cool to get to spend some time with you guys.
Yes. So today we are talking about the law and the priesthood. Now, Dave loves to tell people that I studied Victorian literature. And I feel like people might feel about Victorian literature the same way they feel about Leviticus, in the sense that it might be an acquired taste, not everyone's favorite, perhaps difficult to get into. So I wanted to ask you, Tanner, kind of what brings you to this topic and why has it become of particular interest recently?
Yeah, it's probably not the same reasons you studied Victorian literature, that's for sure. I think the two main reasons I've dived into this over the past few years is I was really intimidated reading through. I mean, Leviticus is where they say Bible reading plans come to die, right? It's the point in scripture where people are like, I don't know what to do. It doesn't read like the rest of the books. I don't know how to interpret it. I don't know how to apply it. It seems archaic. And so that was a big part of it for me, is I was just really intimidated by it. And the second reason is I didn't understand the heart aspects of the law. The New Testament and the New Covenant have a lot of language that seems to suggest that there are elements of the law that are not needed, they're not necessary anymore in our discipleship and the ways that we follow Jesus. But then there's amazing passages like Romans 2 and Hebrews 8 that talk about this heart of the law that should never go away. And that was something that I wrestled with being in a church that was New Testament heavy, was, okay, we're not supposed to follow all these aspects of it, but there's this huge heart behind it that is supposed to be pushing me and guiding me and inspiring me in my relationship with God. And I couldn't articulate what that was. And so that was a big prompt for me to jump in and look at it deeper.
So this conversation about the law, the priesthood, ties into this whole era that we are in the middle of right now in the desert, 40 years in the wilderness. And in some ways, there's so much that we're trying to cover here. This 40 years covers so much of the Torah. And to be able to take this at a high level, you know, we started with the idea of the sign. We moved into the Exodus, the wilderness. Last week, we talked about the presence. Even tackling this issue of priesthood and law in one is something else, right? So we called that first episode the sign, and there was a reason we called it the sign. If everyone remembers, we played off this passage in Exodus 3 because we saw that kind of as a continuity of what God was doing. What is Yahweh doing with Israel? And I think it would be good for us to start there to give this some framework. So Hannah, could you read Exodus 3:12 for us?
He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you, that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.
Yeah, so we talked about this passage being at this place where Moses is encountering Yahweh in this theophany, as we've discussed. And Yahweh says he's going to end up coming back to the same place, but this time he'll have Israel with him. And that's where we actually end it up now, right? So we're now in this place where Israel's come back. So Exodus is really a book that has two very distinct halves. The first half of Exodus is chapters 1 to 18. It's all about Moses' life, the Exodus itself, entering the wilderness. But now we enter into this kind of second half of Exodus in chapter 19. And Yahweh is about to engage Israel in this communal covenant now with himself at Sinai. So some of these threads that we've been pulling on in, what are we in, episode 24, these threads are starting to connect in ways. You remember, Hannah, that you talked about the tapestry in one of our early episodes. I think some of that's starting to happen now is we're seeing these promises of Abraham that are being fulfilled. We're seeing these threads starting to weave together to form a beautiful tapestry in your analogy. So one of the other things that we showed early on was these seven promises to Abraham. And we'll put this back up for the people that are watching online and they can take a look. But what's happening right now is we're kind of in this place where this fourth promise from Genesis 12, I will make you into a great nation, is happening. So last week we had this fascinating conversation with Bernie McGinn, and we talked about the role of God taking this physical manifestation amongst Israel. And now we're looking at some of the infrastructure, the framework of how Israel's forming their nation. And that's what plays into this conversation, right? The covenant that they're going to have with Yahweh, the law, or how they're going to treat one another, and the big picture of why that's so important, even as a community, how they're going to work together, who's going to intercede, who's going to have different roles, how they structure. You know, we're not getting it into the military, but all that stuff starts getting developed here. So, you know, again, there's a lot going on. So at this higher level, this introduction of the second half of Exodus, there's this really key passage, Hannah, that maybe you can read for us in Exodus 19, that really gives this kind of framework. It shows the heart behind it and what's happening. And it sets us up for this conversation for law and priesthood.
Now, therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the Israelites.
Yeah, so in this kind of intro statement, there's a couple key things that set this conversation up. One is that the community of Israel is called to keep Yahweh's covenant. So Yahweh will be the one at the beginning and the end of the covenant, starting it, completing it. But there's an important part that Israel plays, that in order to be the treasured possession, they do have to live in obedience. There's expectations that give them this special status. And that's one of those things we talk a lot about in the podcast, is tensions, right? It's important to say, yeah, God is, Yahweh is the fulfiller of the covenant, but we also have to live in obedience. Both are true. And so the other thing that's important for this conversation is that they're going to be this priestly kingdom, or a priestly royalty, or royal priests. So when we think about that, this often gets lost with Israel, that God's intent was always for the world. It wasn't just for Israel. They were supposed to be the beginning of this connection to the rest of the world, the priesthood to the nations. So as we get set up, and I know Tanner's going to lead us in some of this conversation around the law, and then we're going to move into the priesthood. But there's some key foundational things that we have to think about here in this covenant. One, Yahweh is the one taking the initiative here with Israel. Yahweh's called them to Sinai. He's going to fulfill this covenant. He's going to be the driver of this covenant. So that's important. This is God's initiative. Number two, Yahweh really highlights the special status that we have as his people, or certainly that Israel did. So the vision was this kind of special intimacy, this partnership that reflects back to the Garden of Eden. And it's going to be kind of rekindled now with Israel in this wilderness space. Number three, as we've already said, the condition of the covenant is that Israel's obedient to the covenant. And that's important. And then number four, which we're going to see how the law plays out, is there's obligations that come with this for Israel, the Ten Commandments, the Book of the Covenant. So that's all in the background here as we're setting this up for this conversation. And now enters this idea of the law.
Yeah, there are a lot of high level kind of concepts here. Thank you, Dave, for kind of giving that overview. And I wonder, Tanner, if you could help us get a big picture, or maybe even a summary. A word we've been using in previous episodes is the meta narrative, and kind of help us zoom out when it comes to kind of the law and the priesthood.
Yeah, I think the law, and I mentioned earlier when we're not intimidated by it like I was previously, but I think it's one of the best verbal depictions of Yahweh's holiness, of God's holiness and his character. In a lot of ways, it's like the anti-definition of holiness. Sometimes we define things by saying clearly what they are, and we can describe it. There are synonyms, or there are words, or there are apt descriptions. But sometimes we can define things by saying what they are not, the inverse of something or the opposite. And I think sometimes these really lofty religious words are hard to define without using other big religious words. And so we kind of chase ourselves around in a circle defining religious words with religious words. And so I think sometimes when you read the law and you say, okay, this isn't holy, it helps us to understand what holiness could be like. So in all of this, I think it's really important for me as I read this to remember that the relationship between Yahweh and his people is really pretty fresh at this point. It's they're getting to know him in this more formal way for the first time. These things are being described, and you know, we read backwards, and so we know a lot more about it. But in this meta narrative, this is all very, very new for them. And seeing, so understanding his holiness and then reading and understanding the law kind of go hand in hand in a lot of ways. And I was wondering if you could read this quote by A.W. Tozer. I think it does a really good job of describing God's character in regard to his holiness.
Of course, yeah. God's holiness is not simply the best we know, infinitely bettered. We know nothing like the divine holiness. It stands apart, unique, unapproachable, incomprehensible, and unattainable. The natural man is blind to it. He may fear God's power and admire his wisdom, but his holiness he cannot even imagine.
So I think when you read this and you understand, or you strive to understand what holiness means and what the law looks like, I think in a lot of ways the law is the answer to the human limitations that you talked about in episode 9 of the podcast, coming in Genesis 3, coming out of the garden. You know, up until that point, man was living in an abundant garden, walking in close proximity with God in relationship. It was physical. It was relational. But man didn't understand his limitations. He didn't respect the difference between himself and God. And that ended up leading to a separation of man having to leave the garden. And so in that section, the holiness of God became apparent through that difference between God and man. So you fast forward now, God's rescued his people out of darkness, out of limitation. He's delivered them. He's giving them identity and leadership and covenant and law and all these amazing things. And then he says, even the greatest thing is I want to put myself right in the middle of your camp. I want to come down and I want to live right here again. The catch is, God's people need to begin to understand what these limitations are in a way that they didn't the first time. And when they do, he's promising, I'm going to lead you back to that abundant promised land again. But there's an understanding of those limitations that has to work in order for the relationship to work.
That is such an important thing that's being developed here that I think we're going to see play out quite a bit in this whole story. So you have God's presence entering in this conversation. But then you also have these boundaries, these rules, these, you know, consecrate yourself. Don't touch the side of the mountain. I mean, there's boundaries set up so that we understand creator and created. And law helps that to happen, right? That there's something very different about God in us. So we want God in our presence, but we can't be too familiar, too comfortable, right? So I appreciate you bringing that out. I think that's a really important thing that's happening here. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in all of this, it's really a massive pivot back towards Eden, coming out of the Exodus and God is dwelling here. And it's borrowing that language, but it's really turning back and aiming in that direction again, about living in that proximity to God, living in that correct order of a relationship, a creator created, a father and child. And so in all of that, I don't read the law and, you know, maybe at first glance, but upon reading and studying it with that heart, I don't find it to be limiting. I don't think God is exercising a curfew against fun for his people or trying to limit any of the activities he can do. I think it's God's cheat code for how he's going to dwell amongst his people again. These people that are common, they're limited, they have limitations, they're sometimes sinful, but God wants that full life with him and his people dwelling, coexisting in that proximity, in that relationship again. And so that's the beauty of the law as it moves back towards Eden.
Yeah, so I think that's all true. There's something else that you touched on that I want to maybe pull on, which is the idea that the law is actually for us to have the best possible life. It's creating standards for the community where God in love and for love is helping to set us up for success, for fulfillment. I remember, you know, when our kids were younger, you know, you have family devotionals with your kids as you're trying to train them in the way that you want them to be. And when they were probably 10, 12 years old, we started having these conversations about what do mom and dad really want for you in life? And we talked about these at the time, you know, it was kind of this, hey, I have 7 goals. And we used to talk with our kids about these 7 goals. These are the things that matter when you grow up. And it was things like, we want you to be spiritual because we know that your spiritual life will shape everything. So that means we want you to know God and think about, you know, God and integrate that. We want you to value family. We want you to understand your own financial, you know, situation and be able to balance your checkbook and plan accordingly. We want you to have great relationships. We want you to have a great character. We want you to be healthy. So we talked about, you know, how we eat and take care of ourselves. We want you to find a career that's meaningful to you. So why do I say all that? You know, as a father, when you're setting up your children, you're introducing them to the world, you're training them towards this way where you know this is where your life will be fullest. And when you sit back and read the law, if you don't get stuck in these, you know, you don't get stuck in these crevices. That's what you see happening here, that God is creating this amazing way for our community to work together, for justice. All those things are at play. So I think that's important, the big picture of what's happening.
Yeah, when we think about kind of the nitty-gritty aspects of the law, at a glance, it can feel quite clear that this had a very specific purpose for Israel. If we are reading them today, and definitely a big if, because I think, as you've said, Tanner, that these passages can largely go overlooked or can stump people. But for those that do kind of persevere with these passages on the law, it's not always clear what we should take from them today as modern contemporary readers and the role that they should play in our lives. I think even it can sometimes even be viewed negatively from the way we see the teachers of the law, say, portrayed in the New Testament as kind of overbearing and hypocritical. But I think it is significant that even Jesus says that he didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. So what role do you think that reading these passages should serve for us today? Are they intended to make us maybe more reverent? I think about Josiah's reaction to the law, kind of tearing his robes, that reverence. Or perhaps more appreciative of grace. So yeah, I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I think you know, you mentioned reverence and gratitude, and I think those are both really healthy responses for us to have when we read the law. You know, of course, there's this meta-narrative, which you guys are describing how this kind of fits into God developing his people. But in terms of our response, I think those are really great responses to it. You know, I grew up hearing often in lessons, this idea of, you know, I need to be set apart, which is this idea of holiness, which comes from the law. Many youth camps and different devotional settings and, you know, be different from your friends at school and your friends at work and don't drink or smoke or sleep around and, you know, be set apart from them, be different from the people that aren't following God. Almost like it's like behavioral moralism or something like that. And which, you know, as a teenager and then as a young adult who was developing convictions to follow God and to avoid sin, there was a part of that that was helpful for me to understand some of those things. But I think it's really easy to preach, don't be like them, and to miss out on actually be like God, be like Yahweh, who's dwelling in the midst of the camp. And I think that's what the law does. You can not be like them and still not be like God. And so, and if that makes sense, you know, this idea of being set apart from them in a lot of ways, if that's the way that I'm thinking, I'm actually making them my reference point instead of making God my reference point. Now, I do think when we do follow God, like Dave talked about, when we follow the law and his character and the things there, we will be different from the world, and God intends that. But I think there were many times when I was younger where my focus was so much on don't be like the world that my reference point actually became more of the world instead of God dwelling in the midst. And I can't imagine, you know, being in an Israelite camp, having this billow of fire just continuously roaring, God's presence right in the middle of the camp, and thinking, well, let me make sure I'm not like the other people around me. Like, that would almost be comical to miss out on this glory that's right there in the middle of the camp that I should be focusing my eyes to the whole time.
That's interesting. That's one of the things I think that Bernie brought out last week in our podcast, was just the role that the presence of God plays in helping to shape the way we orient ourselves in the world. And I think that's even what the law is doing. So you brought up the point, Tanner, this is all new, right? They're getting to know Yahweh. Yahweh's getting to know them. They're establishing themselves as a community. They're building basic frameworks. Philosophically, how are we going to work? Morally, how are we going to work? Socially, how are we going to work? How are we going to behave as a community? How are we personally responsible for things? How do we understand justice as a community? And really, that's all these, it's kind of like these tent pegs that are being put into place by Yahweh through this whole process of developing the law, that we're learning things about, even these basic concepts that to us, as you say, we look back and think, of course, but that punishment should match the crime. Where did that come from? The law. Right? That we're actually responsible for each other as a society. Where does that come from? The law. That justice is an integral and key part of this whole thing, right? How we treat people matters. Where does that come from? The law. So these foundations are being built as that rolling pillar of fire is in the middle of the camp.
Mm. Yeah, actually, you're speaking about justice and kind of these different things we've taken from the law. I think something I remember noticing and appreciating when reading Leviticus for the first time was the differentiation that I noticed take place even between people that had different circumstances. So I remember reading in Leviticus 12 about how the family were too poor to, say, offer a lamb as a sacrifice. They could bring two pigeons or two doves. There was like another alternative. And then I remember reading the Gospels and seeing that take place as the offering that Mary and Joseph give to pigeons, or now I'm thinking that's where the song comes from, two turtle doves, as their kind of offering, which was an indication of poverty. Now that was kind of a matter of ceremonial uncleanness, I guess we'd say. So not a sin issue, but like a temporary state for her, in their case, following birth that required purification. So not moral uncleanliness or moral impurity. But I know all these concepts are inextricably related to God's holiness. I know you began to speak about that, Tanner, and I wonder if you could speak more to the idea of holiness. I think you already mentioned that challenging verse that we can grapple with is that it's the one that says, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy," which suggests that it's not just a state that God is in, but one that we're also called to imitate. You talked about kind of making God our reference point and not people. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, holiness is one of those, like I mentioned earlier, those religious buzzwords. It's kind of hard to define it sometimes, or you come up with an analogy and, you know, analogies always fall short. But there's one that I've heard in quite a few different variations of an analogy where God is like the sun. I want to be careful because there's a lot of other world religions where God is the sun. But I'm from the analogy standpoint, you know, God is like the sun in the sense that we need it for life. We need it for growth. It sustains. We need to get outside and get vitamin D. It's good for you. But there are layers of protection that we need against the sun, because in its raw state, we cannot handle it. You know, we wear sunglasses and we put on sunscreen, and, you know, the atmosphere of the earth actually absorbs, I don't know, it's close to 45% of the radiation from the sun just gets absorbed in the atmosphere before it even comes down to us. And we still need layers of protection from it. And that analogy helps me to understand holiness a little bit more of, there's this radiance of God's being and his character that is engulfing and impacting me, you know, and certainly the closer I get to it, the more careful I need to be, but the more benefit that I receive from it. I think a lot of times when I hear that verse that you referenced, there are times where, like, I want to explain it away. You know, I can't be perfect and therefore I can't be holy. And so what does this verse mean? But I think that's, I don't know, I just think that's it's a bit ridiculous that something shouldn't be the goal just because I can't obtain that goal. Like, any goal that God sets should have to be something that within my own power I achieve. And so because I can't achieve it, that shouldn't be the goal. That's a ridiculous way of understanding what I'm made to be. And so the fact that it is out of my reach, once again, it just affirms that human limitation. Part of holiness and God's being is a constant reminder that I am not God. And so the beauty, the power, the relationship, it's all the radiance, the proximity, it's all there, but it's also that reminder that I'm not like God. And I think that's the bigger picture as I'm reading through this. And we talked earlier, and I think you asked about gratitude and grace and reverence. And I think as I read the law, that's something that constantly comes to my mind still, is I am not God. And there's a difference between him and I, and I'm going to embrace that.
So that's probably a good place for us to turn and talk about why we need a priesthood. Why do we need intercessors? And priesthood will work at two different levels in the story. So we've already talked about Israel as a nation of priests. So Israel represents Yahweh to the world as Yahweh's treasured possession. So in that sense, we are, as God's people, priests. But there's another aspect of priesthood that becomes really important here. Israel's going to have one devoted tribe, the Levites, that will serve the community, and they will perform this very specific role. Again, without being able to do a deep dive, there are some kind of key things that the priests do. Some things that we're kind of more aware of than others, but, like, we know they conduct the sacrifices, they maintain the sanctuary, they perform the judicial functions. So they're part of the process of trying to figure out justice. They bless the people. They play a very intercessory role. They're part of the purity, you know, keeping purity for the people. But one of the other really important things that happens that we don't always talk about is the role that they played as teachers. They were expected to know the law, and they were to instruct people, and they moved from tribe to tribe, providing that kind of teaching. And they also played a really critical role in the festivals that we'll get into when we talk about that a little bit more. So the role of the priests was foundational to this religious and social life of Israel, and it really connects with the holiness of God and facilitating their obedience to this covenant because of that huge disparity that you're talking about, Tanner.
So a great example is this idea that if you want to eat, you have to cook. And if you want to cook, you have to clean, which means that nourishment and sustenance and hospitality and relationship all comes packaged with dirty dishes. So you have this meal that's beautiful, but then you've got all the pans that need to be washed, and you wouldn't prep your raw meat on a plate and then just pour salad on it. You need hot water, soap. You know, there's a purification process before it can be used to hold the finished meal. And I think, and then it needs to be purified again, you know, afterwards for the next meal. And so that's a bit of it.
So you're saying that the priests are the dishwashers in your analogy?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's it. I definitely think maybe in the sense that it might not have been as fun. You know, I don't, there's aspects of the job that were serious and probably not for everyone. I mean, there's even a story in Leviticus 10 where Aaron's two sons who are serving as priests, they don't perform part of their duty correctly. And the presence of the Lord comes out in fire and it consumes them right there. So, you know, I think the goal of the priest was to mediate between the holy and the profane, you know, meaning just these common things, not profanity like bad language, just common and, right. and uncommon. And so when common things or profane things like people or bowls or garments came into contact with something that was impure or unclean, the common thing would become contaminated. And that contamination could get passed between people and objects. And then if that common thing happened to enter the presence of God, it would be consumed because it wasn't fit to be in the presence of God. So in a lot of ways, what the priests are doing, aside from many of the other roles that you talked about, Dave, is they are helping to perpetually wash the dishes of the Israelite people, keeping the things clean to provide this vital role in the relational dynamic of the family that is this growing nation of Israel. And I think in a lot of ways, there's this really cool picture. So in Exodus 26, it describes the curtain of the tabernacle. And so Exodus specifically describes that there should be cherubim, you know, angels woven into it. And this is the curtain that keeps people out, that keeps people separate from. And even at the end of Exodus, when Moses comes down, he has to stand outside the tent and talk to God. And there are these angels that are on there. That's a really big reference back to Eden again, right? When man has to leave the garden in that proximity of God, and there are two cherubim that are placed there, keeping man out of it. And so, but one of the amazing things about this now, because of the law and because of the priesthood, there's a designated allowance now. Once a year, on one day, one person, the high priest, can actually get past those two angels, right? Can intercede for the people directly in relationship with God. And I know that might not seem like a huge thing, like it's one person, one day a year, but for people that were separated from God, I mean, once again, this is a huge pivot back to that Edenic state of relationship with God again. And the priests, in particular, the high priest in that situation are crucial to God's people being able to dwell that close. And that's part of the heart of the law that's coming up here.
I love that reference back to Eden. So we've spoken often in the podcast about the meta-narrative being beginning in a garden and ending in a garden. And it's helpful actually to see the law as perhaps this means of restoring the intimacy between God and man that was first enjoyed in the garden, and a means of kind of recreating Eden in a fallen world, or pointing mankind back to that origin place.
Yep. Yeah, you know, as we bring this episode in for landing, there's something we haven't really discussed yet. But when you look at the Torah, these five books, the last book in the Torah is Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. So after these 40 years in the desert, they're kind of queued up right before the Jordan River. They're ready to cross over into this promised land now that they've been waiting for. And Deuteronomy is kind of a repetition. It's a retelling. It's a reminding of what's happened over the last 40 years to bring them to this place. And there's a great passage in Deuteronomy 8 that really brings to a head a lot of these concepts and ties them together, creates the tapestry with some of these themes or threads that we've been pulling on. Hannah, if you could read this, I just want to talk about this passage a little bit. And I really want to encourage our listeners to listen to these kind of key threads we've been building on, from covenant and commandment and humility and God's presence and his sustenance. I mean, all of it, it's kind of there, and we start seeing all this come together.
The entire commandment that I command you today, you must diligently observe. so that you may live and increase and go in and occupy the land that the Lord promised on oath to your ancestors. Remember the long way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. He humbled you by letting you hunger, then by feeding you with manna, with which neither you nor your ancestors were acquainted, in order to make you understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. The clothes on your back did not wear out, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a parent disciplines a child, so the Lord your God disciplines you.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, thanks for selecting this passage at the end here. I think it's just, it's a beautiful passage in a lot of ways to summarize what we were talking about. The relationship that it used to describe God and man is that of a parent and a child, which is just, it's a beautiful relationship. It's one of my favorite relationships is the one that I have with my own kids. But I'm not equal with my kids. You know, I love my kids. I would sacrifice and do anything for them. I want to be with them. I don't want there to ever be a day where they're too cool for me and they don't want to be around me, although, you know, maybe they will when they're teenagers or something. But I also made them and I raised them. And the way I show my love to them is different than the way that they show their love to me. And I think that's a bit of the hermeneutical lens, the way that I'm interpreting the law is through relationship with God, and specifically that relationship of a creator and a created, or a parent and a child, not as peers. So that's how I try and seek to understand some of these nuanced or unfamiliar aspects of the law and the priesthood and how they apply and make sense in my world today.
Well, I think that's why the meta narrative is so important, because it keeps us focusing on what really matters in the story. And I appreciate you bringing all that out. That's exactly right. So we are looking here now at this Yahweh in love and for love shaping Israel to become this nation that can be a light to the world. And that's hard and it's challenging and it comes with all these implications. But if we get stuck, if we get lost in that, which we often do too as Christians, right? We get too caught up in the details and we miss the big picture. This is God in love and for love guiding us. So it's good. This is a good conversation. I know we spent a little bit more time on the story and very little time on the spirituality. This is, again, one of those big concepts to absorb. Why is God calling me to obedience in my life and fill in all the blanks? Why is this life so challenging? Why self-denial? Why surrender? Why? It's for the same reasons. And so hopefully we can spend some time this week kind of thinking about that, unpacking that in our prayer lives and all the other things that we're doing. So Tanner, thank you so much for joining us, for all your insights. It's really good to have you. And I think, Hannah, we have two more episodes left in this series. Yeah. Next week, we're getting into the tabernacle. So that'll be fun. We're going to start pulling on all the details of the tabernacle. So we'll see you back next week, Hannah. Tanner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanner.
See you again soon. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for joining this Thread conversation.
We're more than a podcast. Check out threadpodcast.org for more immersive content.
Though I'm waiting on you, I get a better view of this boundless world.